Coming up on This Week in Google, I'm Jason Howell. I'm here with Stacey Higginbotham and then Danny Sullivan from Search Engine Land. We're going to talk all about internet safety for children, what the future of the Internet of Things will bring, specifically for our civil liberties and how we allow that to happen, how Google is fighting bad ads and letting the good ones, its own, stick around, and a whole lot more. Twig is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 408, recorded Wednesday, June 7th, 2017. Being Internet Awesome. It's time for This Week in Google, the show where we talk about, well, it's in the name, Google, but we're also going to talk about a bunch of other things. Leo Laporte, obviously, not here today. He's on week one of two, 3 weeks. I don't know. He's away, enjoying his life, not podcasting. I'm Jason Howell. I'm filling in for Leo this and next week, and happy to be here. Super stoked to welcome back Stacey Higginbotham, of course, creator of the IoT Podcast at iotpodcast.com. And the Internet of Things newsletter at StaceyOnIoT.com. An occasional dancer.
Always dancing.
All right, good. Dance like no one's watching, except everybody's watching because you're on a podcast. That's the extended version of that saying. Also joining us is Danny Sullivan, founding editor of Search Engine Land and Marketing Land. And it's great to have you back, Danny. It's always fun to do a
good
podcast.
Good to be back. Thanks.
Yeah, so I don't know how to kind of get this ball rolling. I'm just excited to be here and excited to have you guys on board. Should we start with some Google stuff? Does that make the most sense? I mean, or we could start with Apple, but I'm sure that
I was
going
to start with
people.
Whatever Danny wanted to start with, because good Lord, he is raring to go.
Yeah, I know. He was shadowboxing.
we can dance where you want to, whatever.
All right. Hey, why don't we do that then? I think this is a great place to start. Danny, you wrote about Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal has had a program where if you searched for a Wall Street Journal article through Google search, it would bypass the paywall and it would let you through and you feel like you're getting away with something. Many times I go to a Wall Street Journal article and it would give me, you know, it would show me the three paragraphs and then tell me I had to like sign up. I'd open up another browser, search for the name of the article, go through the result, and I'd have my way in. That doesn't work right now. But you wrote about this. Tell us a little bit about the change that's happened.
Well, it actually came off of a good Bloomberg article, so be sure that people read the Bloomberg article as well. And they had done an interview with the Wall Street Journal, and in February, the Wall Street Journal dropped out of this program that's called First Click Free. And the way First Click Free works is that if you have subscription content behind a paywall, you can still be listed in Google and have that stuff show up just like any normal article, as long as you guarantee to let somebody click through and see the article for free. And there's like a maximum of 3 articles per month or per visitor session that they can do. Well, the Wall Street Journal felt like this was getting abused. They said, I think they had like 1 million people a month that were just using Google to go through and view articles for free this way. And so they shut it all down. In February, they said, thanks, but no thanks. We don't want to do First Click Free, so end that program. And so one of the downsides to that is then if you don't allow Google to come through your paywall, then it only gets sort of the first 3 or 4 paragraphs of your article. And so if there are lots of long-tail terms or there's material that's further down, Google can't read it, doesn't understand what your article is about. And so potentially you're not going to get as many visitors because you're not going to show up for as many topics. The other thing is that when you do show up, there's going to be a little subscription label that shows up next to you in Google News, not in Google Web Search, but in Google News. And people might say the subscription thing there and think, well, I don't have a subscription, so I'm not going to click through. I'm done. And they said that the traffic, you know, after they did this from Google, dropped 44%. And so, and they seem upset about that. Like, well, we feel like that's unfair. We should be showing up just as well as we were before. But on the other hand, one of the reasons they did this is that they said they were getting greater conversion when they cut people off into becoming paid subscribers. So they were getting less traffic, but then they also said that their conversion of paid subscribers has gone up fourfold. So it's sort of a balancing act. You know, do you want the free traffic that you're monetizing with ads, or do you want less traffic, but when you're not giving it away, people are more inclined to then pay for it? And I think they're kind of feeling their way with it and now kind of figuring out what's next, you know, but clearly not happy with the traffic drop. Otherwise, I don't think they would have mentioned it.
How long was this project in place? I feel like for quite a while, right? A few years at least.
Oh, yeah. First Click Free goes back at least to 2008. Okay. Most publications make use of it that have paywalls. You know, it's kind of seemed a good balancing act, but it's come under fire over the years. The New York Times, for example, gets very, very restrictive about it. And yet, and the Wall Street Journal is the same. On social media, they are much more liberal. So you want a free read for something that they shared on social media? Cool. But you want a free read from something you found in Google? Not so cool. And they still kind of seem to view social media as, you know, a marketing platform for them or worth the free giveaway there. Whereas, you know, they kind of view Google as somehow, you know, freeloaders are just coming in and stealing all their traffic and all their pages for free. Although in both of those cases, it's not like those pages don't have ads on them.
Right.
And that's ultimately the thing here. It's like, well, if you're a subscription website and you feel like you're losing subscriptions, why do you have all the ads on that stuff? And that's because, really, you're not just a subscription website. But so, yeah, that's where we're at. And I'm waiting to hear back. I don't know if I will hear back, but I did try to follow up with the Wall Street Journal to find out, well, is the new subscriptions you're getting offsetting the amount of money that you're losing in potential ad revenue, and also what they think the solution should be. You know, the balancing act I think Google faces is, do we show, you know, you have a limited amount of articles and listings you can show in search results. Most people do not have subscriptions to these publications. So do you take up some of that space putting things in there that causes a user to click on them, and then maybe the majority of them get frustrated? And then when they get frustrated, they don't blame the Wall Street Journal for having a paywall. They blame Google for, like, why'd you put this thing that wasn't useful to me? Hmm. But there's also an argument, I wrote about this about 2 or 3 years ago, where, you know, potentially if Google puts more subscription content up there, it causes people to understand there's more value to it. It's like, yeah, you want this news content, you pay for it. So, you know, start paying.
Yeah, as long as people are actually doing that conversion. Now, you mentioned that there are other sites that are also, like that this is a pretty common thing. I'm sure there's a lesson here for those sites to learn. Is there any, like, clear kind of advice to come out of this switch, this decision that Wall Street Journal made, that other sites that are trying to do this have learned?
Well, I think you need to understand, and I think, like, the Times of London and some other places have learned this in the past too, that if you put up barriers to Google coming into your website, you're going to get less Google traffic. That's SEO 101. And so you kind of have to understand, is that worth the trade-off? You know, it's very easy that people want to beat on Google, especially in the news industry, that they're somehow stealing all their traffic and screwing them up. And then it's like, well, so apparently the Wall Street Journal was getting a lot of traffic from Google without paying for any of that traffic, by the way, and traffic that they found so useful that they're now upset about it. So, and this is from a company whose, you know, CEO and leaders have been merciless in slamming Google as this, like, horrible thing to news industry. It's just like, so now you're upset when you took your stuff out, you didn't get all the free stuff in the first place. So I guess it's kind of like, make up your mind. Do you want the free traffic from Google? And if you do, then you understand these are the trade-offs that are coming with it. Or do you become very segmented in what you're doing? You understand what content you want to give away for free. You've got that in a way that you can list it in a way for free. And, you know, you've got your subscription content, and maybe you're being much more religious about it really is subscription content. We're not having all these holes that are in there.
Yeah. And I wonder what's kind of a valuable metric for the Wall Street Journal, in the sense that, you know, is straight up page views on these articles important? Obviously, money is important to run the business, but
right.
They have to do the conversion in order to pull that off. There's got to be value on both sides. And if they're serving up ads, and we can talk more about ads in this next story here, but if they're serving up ads, at least they're making something. But I guess we just don't know what they're making in comparison.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of ads, Google is we kind of had heard a little bit about this in the past, and now it's becoming a little bit more clear. Google is going to be including an ad blocker in Chrome for mobile devices as well as for desktop. I think this is going to happen sometime in early 2018, sometime early next year. And don't know. I'm very curious to get both of your take on this, because it seems like a strange line that's being crossed here. So they're going to be blocking, quote, bad ads. And Google did say including those owned and served by Google. What are bad ads? You know, bad ads would include pop-ups, autoplay ads, flashing image ads, those sorts of things. Basically, sites need to comply with better ad standards per the Coalition for Better Ads to avoid this blocking. But the members of that coalition, of course, are Google and Facebook, which account for somewhere around 99% of digital ad revenue growth in the U.S. last year, 77% of gross ad spend. It seems, I don't know, is there a potential for some... Is Google the right one to make this decision when they are so intrinsically tied into what makes a good ad or a bad ad, and they cover the majority of the market? What do you think?
Well, when your advertiser network sets the quality of your ads, that actually can be a good thing. I see where the problem comes in, but my one question about this, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, is autoplay ads inside content. So if, like, I used to work at Fortune and we had these autoplay ads and autoplay videos that we had to insert into every story. So is that a bad ad, or is that content just really irritatingly delivered?
That's a really great question. I mean, I don't know. I know that anytime there's an autoplay ad on a page, I want to scream.
Any autoplay
same
video.
Net effect for me anyways.
That's a question, because then publishers would probably just hide the ads a little bit more in things that look closer to content. And these are obviously publishers, not like the crazy publishers like Outbrain and stuff that are just crazy clickbait. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, like, that's irritating. And I would call that a bad ad, and it uses my data plan and I get all cranky. So I would love for those to be blocked, or at least to maybe say, hey, do you want to play this before it actually happens?
Right. Yeah. Somewhere a long time ago, I changed the settings, when kind of this conversion to flash or away from flash was happening. And I changed the settings so that anytime there was a flash element on the screen, never make it appear automatically, always ask me. Like, I had to actively enable that module anytime I actually wanted to see whatever the flash content was. Something similar like that, potentially, because that was actually really helpful. I avoided a lot of pain with flash, but I don't know. More and more, we're not really seeing as much flash these days, and that's, I think, a good thing. They say, supposedly, there will be a threshold for sites. So it's not as if a site offers a single bad ad, and at which point Google blocks all the ads on the site. There will be a threshold of, quote, bad ads that would have to be passed on a site before Google would then decide to block all the ads on the site and tell the site or the publisher, you know, went in there and tweaked it and got rid of the bad ones, essentially. Who knows what that threshold will be? But it'll also be active by default. So this is not something that you opt into. It'll be new Chrome browser released. Everybody's getting blocked ads, and you have to opt out of it if you want.
So. Well, I can't see a lot of people choosing to opt out. I can, as a publisher who's trying to get, you know, attention. I'm like, oh, crap. Are my ads going to be bad? I have a pop-up that shows to my readers on the site if they go there. I think it's every 30 days. So, like, it refreshes every month. Yeah. It'll pop up for you the first time you visit for that month, right? And I'm like, oh, I don't love it, but I'm also like, it only happens once a month for people.
Right.
So maybe.
I don't know. What do you think, Danny? Where do you fall on this idea of Google backing this ad blocking?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a good degree of unease of Google's going to have this this way of stripping out ads, especially for their own, you know, but our ads will probably be all right. I mean, when they say, well, our ads will fall under it, you can be sure that by the time they get to this, that will all be cleared up. Like, they shouldn't be running ads that are having that kind of issue.
Right.
What they might have are people who are using their ad serving technology who still do things that they don't like. But I don't know. We'll see how it gets when it's out there and it's implemented. It's really easy that you hear these things come along and they're going to be this big, huge change. And we've had that with Internet Explorer. And I certainly haven't felt like when Internet Explorer said we're blocking ads that really changed things much. We had that when Safari, especially in iOS, rolled out the support for the third parties. And it was like, well, that's it. Ads are dead. And then, like, you know, the ads are still there. And, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people downloaded those extensions to begin with or the apps, and then they didn't seem to do much with it. So, you know, I think the main thing is, are you really introducing something that's going to fundamentally improve the experience, or are we just introducing something that pretty much keeps us seeing all the same kind of ads that we get as before and takes out a little bit of the stuff? And I think a lot of us would like to have some improvement. I think when you go to a website and it's loading up 29 different trackers and, you know, 49 different ads, like, okay, that's a bit much. You know, how do you clean up that experience? So, and they certainly have the platform to do it with Chrome. You know, ultimately, I think I'd feel better about it if I felt the major browser people all together were sort of united. But, you know, I can dream for many things of unity.
Well, and someone posted this in the chat room, and it's worth mentioning just because of who's involved. But Google is going to provide a tool for publishers that they can run to see if their ads are in violation and would be blocked. But the people who are part of this include Google, Facebook, News Corp, and the Washington Post. So that makes me feel like at least big publishers aren't going to be even angrier at Google because of something like this, which, you know, yay.
I think another element of this, too, is that to a certain degree, like if you were to ask anyone who's interested in technology whether they run an ad blocker, there are people that are all for ad blocking because, you know, it's my internet experience, and anything that degrades my experience, I want to get rid of. And there are people that are vehemently opposed to ad blocking. They might not like the ads or the experience that it brings with it, but ethically, they feel like if they're blocking ads, then they're ripping somebody off. And no, I don't want to do that, you know, by any means. So it'll be interesting to have someone, you know, a company as powerful, and especially in, you know, with Chrome, which is something like, what, 44.5% of all web browsers online, according to the data analytics program, you know, compared to all the other browsers, it's kind of blowing them away. To have someone, a company with that kind of backing, putting this out there by default and seeing kind of, I don't know, like when this happens and suddenly all of these ads are being blocked as a result of it, and let's be serious, none of those are going to end up being Google ads because Google's going to take care of it ahead of time, like you said, Danny. Then will the call be, oh, look, Google's just squashing any ad that isn't its own ads because they're bad. And, you know, look who benefits. It's Google, the ones doing the squashing. I don't know if that'll end up being a big issue or not, but I can already see the articles. I can see them. They're flashing before my eyes.
You live in the future.
Yes.
All right.
I'm telling the future right now. Also related to this is something called funding choices, and which is actually, have either of you ever used a Google service called Contributor? I'm sure you've heard of Contributor.
I've heard of it.
Is this the one where you answer the questions?
No. This is basically it's a paid service. I think you choose what you pay up to like $5 or $10 a month or something like that. And what it essentially does is it's ad blocking that you paid for ahead of time, courtesy of Google. With partner sites. So any of the sites that fall under the purview of this, you'd pay like $5 at the beginning of the month. And then that would cover you when you go to those sites. You're a member of this program. You won't actually see the ads on there because instead of seeing them, you kind of paid up front for them. So funding choices is kind of the next phase of Contributor. And what it's going to allow is for sites to sites that work with funding choices to show a custom message to people who are using ad blockers when they hit the site. That custom message can say something like, you can enable ads on our site, or you can pay for Contributor to remove all of the ads, you know, legitimately, let's say. And so that's going to start happening. Apparently, Funding Choices also hides more than just AdSense ads, and every page view, you know, it has an associated ad cost, somewhere around like a penny per page, which I don't know, the way some of us surf the internet, I suppose that could add up to be a lot if you really work it out.
Oh, God, yes. I'm like, oof.
Yeah, penny for page. You know, the monthly cost of that, suddenly your web browser, your broadband cost just doubled because you're paying.
Is it a flat fee that you pay per month?
You can pay a specific fee, but from my understanding, that covers only a certain amount of views, right? Only a certain amount of pages. And then at that point, I'm guessing, I didn't read it, but I'm guessing you would just start seeing ads then at that point. It's like you run out of your funding and you avoided ads but here you go.
So one of those stupid slideshows could be like a full quarter. Yeah, holy cow.
I know, right? That could really add up.
Wow, that would, you would have to think about like, what's interesting, so sorry, I was digressing. What's interesting here is that all of the, what the internet does and what kind of is happening with basically delivering all of this connected content is everything becomes super transactional because we can very clearly understand the costs associated with everything, right? Mm-hmm. And there is no more like hiding things behind like, oh, it only cost me $20 to subscribe to the paper and I'm supporting it. Mm-hmm. But really it's all of the advertisers. So it's kind of a fascinating thing to think about how this plays out and how different sites will be valued and who would pay for what. Just mm-hmm. on a true per page or per, you know, cost of delivering a page basis.
If people are even willing to do it, yeah.
I mean, and one of the gaps with the funding choices thing is that you could have websites that don't have ads who can't participate because there's no ads to block, right? So what they really need is a Google contributor where people can pay, but then they really need a Google contributor where people pay as they land, not where they can say, oh, yeah, I read that. Now I'm thinking after the fact I want to do it. That, you know, potentially you could have sites that just put up fake ads that say support us so that those ads can be blocked for the ad blocking people. But yeah, I agree with you. Maybe we'll get to this shift where people are thinking much more about, you know, I am paying for everything. The web actually isn't free and I'm paying for it one way or the other. Either I'm paying for it because someone's going to be showing me an ad or I'm paying for it because I'm actually shelling out real hard cash.
You're paying for it in terms of your demographic data. Woohoo.
Yeah. So. But, you know, at least it gives an option. When the ad blockers, I think especially on Safari, mobile Safari came out, you would have people then start getting these blocks and they'd be upset. And it's like at least they have a solution now for them, right? It's like, well, if you don't want to turn off your ad blocker on this site, then I guess you can buy this type of thing. Whether they actually then follow through with their principles of I don't want to be see ads to the degree that I'll pay for stuff, we'll see.
Yeah, absolutely. I know Ron Richards on the other show I do on the network, All About Android, he has been using Contributor, I think now for a few years, and he's loved it. So so it's definitely a viable option. It's an interesting kind of approach for this if what you want is to kind of improve, clean up the experience of the web, but not feel like you're just jipping every site that you go to because you've got an all-out, you know, like brick wall ad blocker that's just shoving it all off. So I guess we'll see the value, the actual value to people as far as like if it's worth it to people to remove those ads and to pay a little bit of money up front in order to do it.
Maybe if the ads were more obnoxious, it would be better and worth it. More worth it.
I'm sure they're going in that direction. I mean, Google's got a couple of different fronts here tackling this. And I mean, mm-hmm. essentially, it seems like making money on all sides.
So. Yeah. Yes. We'll show you an really? Ad. We'll let you pay us to block the ad.
Exactly. Let's see here. What else? We've got some other Google stuff. Those were the things that actually interconnected. Now everything is like little pieces here and there. So we can just hop through some of this stuff. I saw this actually today, and I think I missed it. It was yesterday's news that Google is working on an initiative. It's a project that they're calling Be Internet Awesome, and it's a way to educate kids, and I think it's aimed more at younger kids, on how to protect themselves online. It was developed by teachers, internet safety and literacy organizations, and it's a program to kind of advise kids who are just learning about their digital life online to understand, you know, why you should limit sharing your personal information, how you avoid scams, or why, you know, what might be a scam in the making, password health, just in general, avoiding bad behavior online. And they've got a curriculum for classrooms. They've got a game that you can play through that. What is the game called? It's out of my view here.
Interland.
There you go. Interland. That kind of walks you through some of the concepts and everything. And it's all about educating kids on being better internet denizens and protecting themselves. I think this is a great effort.
I do too. I mean, because I will say, as a parent who's tech savvy, it's actually hard to remember all of the things that you kind of take for granted.
Absolutely.
Right? And so having something that codifies it is really helpful. And, you know, we spend time talking to my daughter about, like, not clicking on emails and, you know, posting things online. And, but it's still like, you know, she plays a online game right now, and we had to sit down and we realized that it had, like, chatting. So then we had to talk about, like, hey, don't share your password with people. And, you know,
right.
But it's weird having to, like, teach someone that, but there are people who go around and, you know, scam kids or worse.
Right.
So this is great. I love it because I don't want to have to remember everything.
Yeah. And Google has, it really seems like Google is on a roll right now with really rolling out initiatives and efforts and apps and services into Android. They had Family Link not too long ago that are really designed around kind of improving the family experience with their products. Of course, they benefit because they get, you know, they get users from a very young age to have brand affinity with Google products and to learn it. But, you know, on the flip side of that, we live in a world where all of this stuff is so, you know, pervasive and just a part of life that it's important to kind of know it to a certain, you know, at a certain point, you have to know this stuff. I applaud Google for putting this together and doing it. And I suppose we'll see, you know, it's a free resource. Anyone can go there and check this stuff out. I don't think you have to be in a classroom curriculum in order to do it.
So. I'll get my daughter to go through it and we'll see how we feel about it afterwards. I can tell you guys maybe not next week, but the week after that, I'll tell you guys what we thought. I would say, here's what I would like to see. I would like to see a corollary to this that talks about, like, data collection and how companies like Google and others use your information so kids are aware of that side of the internet too.
Yeah, I guess the big challenge here is that kids are capable of so much, yet you can easily overwhelm them and have information fall off the edge of the cliff. But it's all so important. Like, you know, I was thinking about this just yesterday, the story about how Harvard nixed a bunch of incoming students because of really offensive memes that they placed, you know, that they posted to a private Facebook group. And I don't know how to formulate my thoughts around it exactly, but it kind of ties into this idea that, like, we are of a generation of an age where we've grown up with the internet. Like, at least for myself, the internet came along when I was already kind of a young adult. And so I kind of learned these things over time. But I mean, kids nowadays, like, this is just, they're born and they're surrounded by the internet. And, like, I don't know. Is there a different way of thinking about, like, what's okay to share out there, and how do we let them know that, like, no, this stuff actually has repercussions? Like, oh, by the way, you were accepted into Harvard and now you're not going because you posted this thing on the internet that, even though it's a private Facebook group, is not entirely private. It's not like it was sealed and no one could see it. It's very easy to take a screenshot. It's very easy to do all these things that make something that you think is private is not. And how do you communicate that to kids? And I think that's a really big challenge.
So I will say, we did that with my daughter the second she had access to the internet, which was probably like at age 7. Mm-hmm. We tell her this all the time. Nothing on the internet is private. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Nothing on your phone is private. And, you know, that's I think of web safety and tech savviness is probably similar to teaching your kids about sex education kind of stuff, because you don't overwhelm them with everything all at once, but you have to start talking about it very early. The second, you know, you're seeing them. And I think as parents, you also have to follow through on this yourself. So maybe you don't post, you know, the pictures of your kid in the bathtub on Facebook.
Right.
And, you know, if you do that, maybe you explain to them how you're limiting these settings and that you'll take it down when they're 13 and like, oh my God, mom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not getting their permission to post that photo of them in the bathtub, but getting their permission to actually, you know, post anything on Facebook at all. I stepped away from Facebook back in December. I was just starting to feel a little overwhelmed with kind of the time I was spending scrolling and just some of the decisions that they were making just didn't really ring true to me. And I felt like I needed to step away. But one thing I had been struggling with up until then was this growing kind of need or feeling inside of me to stop sharing as much about my life on the internet, because basically what I'm doing is taking that choice away from my kid and just basically saying, you don't have the choice. I've decided to share all this stuff about you. And more that just felt weird to me. And so I had to do that, you know, giving them more of a voice. What do you think about all this, Danny? I mean, you're a father. I'm sure you've struggled with a lot of these issues.
Well, it's funny. My son had to do a senior project. And so it's for a senior project. His was going to be oversharing on social media. And I was like, all right. Because I'm an oversharer around the house. Yeah. I don't know. I think we talked with our kids about some safety things early on when they've done, you know, online gaming and stuff like that. We've talked to them about, you know, don't take requests from strangers, don't do things from people you don't know. I think we've been fortunate that they've been pretty savvy and kind of come up with it at the same time. But, you know, I think the education stuff is all very good. I remember Eric Schmidt once talking about the idea that every teenager at 18 ought to have the right to just completely cleanse out their record. And I thought, oh, that's crazy. And it probably still is crazy in the sense that you could do it. But, you know, you kind of think, yeah, actually, you've got people sharing stuff that really don't understand the longer term repercussions of what they're doing. And, you know, they probably could use a good cleanse in a lot of ways. And then at the same time, I think we'll also be going into a culture that will become more accepting of this stuff. If you go back to the idea of, like, you know, I think it was when Clinton was like the first president who said he ever smoked pot, and that you finally got through this point where, okay, I guess that doesn't end it, that I don't want to excuse the things that people may post, but that people may become more or less shocked about that sort of stuff. That is, oh, you have this weird thing you posted when you were 15? Yeah, okay, everybody's got something like that. Mm-hmm. But overall, I like the idea of better education, of teaching kids to think more about what they're doing, that you don't need to share all this sort of stuff. Certainly the idea, I think one of the things that I find most tragic to me is when you find people who especially feel like they're doing all this effort to present themselves in a special way on social media that aren't feeling that way internally. And, you know, that I'm going to make myself look great, but I actually feel awful. And, you know, you kind of want to say, I just wish you had, you know, actual people that you know who are there to support you and tell you that you're loved so that you don't feel like you've got to express it that way out on social media. So.
Yeah, anyway. That's a really good point. I mean, at one point it seemed like social media, you know, is a tool that allows you to express yourself. And then at another point, it becomes a tool that allows you to portray yourself as something that you wish you were or something that you aspire to be, but you're not. And that could be self-defeating because you're not, yet you're portraying yourself in this very public sort of sense that you are. I can't even imagine being a kid like having to figure out what is the right approach on something like that. It's hard enough.
But it's
figuring out how to be authentic in person.
It's crazy too, because you think on the one hand, you know, when I was like 7 or 8, I would walk home from school alone, you know, for like a mile. Mm-hmm. In the snow, but okay, maybe there was the snow, but
uphill, you walked in the snow.
You walked home from home. You went out, you had a key, you went to your house alone, you know, we'd get dropped off at maybe Disneyland and it was like you had your dime and you just wandered around. And like, I got to find my friends. I know where all my kids are. I know what's going on with them. I know they have their cell phones. It doesn't make them perfectly safe, but our ability to watch over what our kids are doing versus, say, what I had when I was growing up is hugely different. I mean, before you could have said, well, I'm at a friend's house. And now it's like, if you weren't at a friend's house, I can tell because I can either see it or I know that you've turned something off or you've done something to kind of cover your tracks. So I could tell that, you know, that wouldn't be the case if that's going on. Plus the idea that, you know, I think a lot of us really usher our children around. The idea that kids just wander around is, you know, feels less and less of a type of thing. So on the one hand, I think there's an increase in the physical world safety as we've developed as a society. And now it's just weird or bizarre or strange, or it's just a whole new world where the virtual world safety now has a lot of catching up to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is super true. How do I'm very interested in this topic, obviously, as a parent of two kids, and they are right at the point right now. Definitely, you know, my older daughter is 7, and so I'm kind of at this critical point where she's very interested in technology, and I know I need to educate more around this. One of the struggles that I have is this idea that, like you said, Danny, we've got, as parents nowadays, we have all these tools that we can use that are available to us for free to be able to kind of track how our kids use the internet, track how our kids move across the landscape of the real world and all of these things. And I struggle with this kind of weird place where how do our kids respond to being watched all that time? You know, that's certainly, when I was a kid, right, I could go to someone's house, I'd at the very least leave a message and say, hey, I'm over at so-and-so's house, I'm gonna be there until 9 o'clock, then I'll walk home and everything's fine. Nowadays, like, we would not allow for that. We require so much more because we have access to all these tools to know so much more. But how does that affect kids who are growing up now with that kind of oversight, and what does that lead to 20 years down the line? Obviously, we don't know the answer to that, but got any guesses?
I don't.
You don't have to do it.
Yeah, well, that's true.
That out there. Like,
you don't have to do it. You're right.
I'm like, we give my daughter a phone, but, you know, when she's going to walk to, like, her friend's house, which we let her do. So she walks to her friend's house and she's supposed to text us when she gets there. And then she's supposed to text us when she leaves. So we can kind of keep an eye. And it's the same thing. Like, I was a latchkey kid. When I arrived home from school, I had to call my mom first thing. And if I didn't, you know, I would get a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yep. And to tie this back into Google, I'm sure you guys talked about it on This Week in Google when it launched a few months ago. But Google Trusted Contacts is an app that you can put on that's very, very close to what we're talking about here, kind of selecting contacts that you know, want to stay connected with from, you know, in a sense of personal safety, emergency, your close friends, siblings, basically sharing your location. So you're walking from point A to point B and you want to make sure that, you know, somebody that you trust is kind of looking over you in a digital sense. So there are tools that Google offers to help facilitate this stuff. And we have the ability to do so much with the device in our pocket.
That's cool. Well, how old is your kid going to be when they get their device, their first device, Jason?
Well, so I guess it depends on what is defined as their device. They don't have their own device. I have a 4 and a 7-year-old. They don't have their own device necessarily. But every weekend, each of them has a tablet that they can use for two hours each day. And, you know, they have YouTube Kids on there, so it's the kids' version of YouTube, and that's really all they ever do. Maybe play a handful of games, but it's really that. So I think in their minds, they own those tablets. They don't own those tablets. They aren't going anywhere with those tablets. If we go on a trip, we might bring them, you know, we'll bring them and they can play on them. But I don't know. I don't know what the right age is to say, here's a phone. Have fun, because, I mean, I'm already getting into conversations with my 7-year-old about how friends at her school, some of her friends have phones. I'm like, are you serious?
It's weird because, yeah, some of my friend, my daughter, she's going into sixth grade, which feels like a time that might happen with a phone. But, like, her friends, like, call her on our phone, not for social because they don't talk on the phone, but they call, like, for projects or something, or just to snag her or to get her online a lot of times. So a lot of times they're calling to ask her to go online so they can do, you know, work via Hangouts or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a tough, and I have a feeling that the age at which kids are given their own device has gotten younger and younger over the past probably 10 years, you know, as we've had more of these smartphones and more of our own lives as parents have kind of evolved around relying on these devices. And, you know, lots of these apps are created to enable things like knowing where your kid is at all times and everything. Then it becomes more and more enticing for parents to give the device to them at a younger age. But who knows what the right decision is? That's the hard part about being a parent. You just never know. Anyways, kind of related to this, actually, at least to a certain degree, in this weird kind of world where we're moving into technology and everything's connected and everything. Stacey, you tweeted out, I think today or yesterday, this Pew Research study that
it
really
came out yesterday.
It was yesterday. It was examines the kind of the deeper potential of what the Internet of Things leads to and kind of the future that we can look forward to as the Internet of Things becomes more pervasive. Tell us a little bit about what stood out to you.
Oh, man. So we talked about this a lot on our show today that we recorded because this is something we've been talking about for a while. But the idea is that soon connectivity will not be something you can escape. One, because it'll be in everything, but two, because you'll be required to have it as part of your job or interacting with people or paying for things. And so then it becomes like, man, in this world that we're rapidly moving towards and kind of halfway are in, how do we know what decisions are being made on our behalf? How do we know if it's safe? How do we know, you know, what back-end deals are happening behind the scenes that, you know, show that end up showing you the content that you see? So it's kind of a lot of that. It's a really great report. I encourage everyone to read it. And it has like just scary, scary things like, let's see, unplugging is nearly impossible now, but by 2026, it will be even tougher. Resistance is futile. You can't avoid. And then my next favorite thing is you can't avoid using something you can't discern. So much of IoT operates out of sight that people will not be able to unplug. And I'm like, woo.
Yeah. Yeah. And being kind of pulled into the benefits of something like IoT, like, you know, I've recently upgraded. Once I started upgrading lights in my house to Philips Hue, it's like I want them all on Philips Hue now. And slowly but surely, something that used to be just this passive dumb light bulb has been swapped out in many rooms for something that connects to the internet and can be used in a number of ways for who knows what. We hear about IoT and security all the time. There we go.
Well, and I would like to think, I mean, there are so many positives to this, not just the fact that you may never have to leave your couch again to turn on your lights, but companies do need to be transparent. And there is a real issue. I think The Guardian wrote this up and they made a bunch of good points that, you know, I know that we've made in the past, but when you're doing something like buying something on Amazon Echo, you know, you don't know what the best price necessarily is because you don't see it. You're just saying, do this. And if you set like a reoccurring subscription, there's not necessarily a guarantee that that's going to be, you know, the best available option all the time, right? And there are just so many examples of this. Like, can you imagine your self-driving car maybe taking you a slightly different route based on your personal preferences? Maybe so you drive by a Starbucks and think, oh, yeah, I should totally get that. Those are all things that like Carnival is doing a connected cruise line and they will know your preferences. And I was talking to them about wayfinding because one of the things they want to do is help people negotiate around these epically huge ships. And I was like, so if someone likes gambling, you know, would you send them to, you know, their movie or their brunch by way of a casino? She's like, we might. So, okay. But will the consumers know that?
Right.
That's scary.
Yeah.
Or not?
No. That's a really good point. I mean, so much of that happens, you know, online with advertising. I mean, that's a large part about, you know, how that works. You go to Amazon, you search for something, And then you end up going to a site a day later, and what do you know? That thing is down there, and it's on sale. It's $10 less than it was yesterday. Do you want to buy it now? And, you know, I think it's easy to think that that's all purely coincidental, and, hey, isn't that weird? But as long – and we're okay with it. Many people are okay with it because they understand that that's just how ad tracking, ad marketing works. But if you don't know that happens, then it feels very manipulative.
Yeah, I was I was looking to book a hotel, and I had like three different hotel sites opened, and I found all the rooms between them, picked the one that I wanted, and shut the other two down. And like, I continue to get emails, hey, finish your booking, finish, you know, and I know why it's happening because I've logged in, and they know that I was logged in. They followed me all the way to this or whatever. Yeah. But yeah, if you don't know, and you've been seeing that also where I think there's been a rise where people are convinced that their phones are listening to them, and where they've, you know, said there's the only way that the phone, the only way I could have seen this ad is because I was talking to somebody about this, and you know, it listened to me, and so now it knows that I'm this person who was interested in that. It's like, well, actually, your internet browsing probably gave them that data because it's become that good, but yeah, people don't know.
And yeah. I think people will figure it out over time. You know, that's kind of our job, is to explain some of the stuff that's happening and find good use cases. But, you know, it is becoming harder because for a lot of companies, like I was talking to GE's appliances division, and they're looking at putting connectivity into everything, not because they want to give you necessarily these whiz-bang features, but because they want to understand how their appliances are being used and be able to track and make service calls easier. So I see it totally in the future. Like, maybe you won't get a warranty on something unless you connect it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, wow.
That becomes kind of coercive in a way to a consumer. And, you know, maybe you don't want a connected oven. Maybe you don't want someone knowing when you're cooking or what you're cooking.
Or the stuff that simply dies because you can't connect it. So, like, I recently dug out my Zoom because I don't want to give too much of a spoiler away, but there was a movie where the Zoom got featured in, which was pretty cool. So I went out and I thought, well, I'm going to load this up and I'll put the movie soundtrack on it just for a laugh. And I had to set up a personal web server and download files from a separate thing and alter some other thing to convince the Zoom software that it was connecting to this Microsoft server because the Microsoft server had gone down. And so like, whoa. And like, you couldn't even reset it to go back to its basic mode. Like it was really, really tied in to being connected. And I think more of our devices, somebody else had a device that was like that. The DJI, I always want to say DJI, but it's the DJI drones now. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to have them connected to an account for them to fly. And there's advantages to that because they ensure that they have the right firmware and they know who they are. But then you're like, so in 2 years, if you go away, does my drone die?
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe that's just part of, well, things don't last forever like they used to anyway. Not that things ever lasted forever, but maybe they made it more than a year or two. But yeah, it's kind of scary. Or just our televisions, right? And the whole thing that came up with the Samsung sets or the Vizio sets where, you know, you're monitoring what's being watched, or like, hey, I just want to watch TV. I paid for the TV. You didn't give me a discount. It's not like when I bought my Kindle and they said, do you want to pay $20 more and not get the ads? I paid for the TV. I paid for my direct service every month. I don't want to be data mined in that way, sort of way, unless you're going to give me some good incentive with it, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's what you get for having a TV that plugs into the internet, which is, I mean, pretty much all TVs nowadays. You know, they all have some sort of smart internet enabled functionality on the back end. Some of them are just dumb monitors, but they all have that, and that basically means that, like, the days of just, you know, hooking an antenna up to the TV and it's all passive, I mean, they're numbered at this point because it's all fed through. And that's with the trade-off of convenience and, you know, nice services that we all love, that we look for and everything. So obviously we're getting something from it. It just kind of removes some of the choice, which is kind of one of the parts, you know, one of the points of this Pew research study, is that the more we go down this path, the less choice we as users actually have to avoid it if we so choose. It's going to be next to impossible to step away from it. And then you get into this weird world of like, okay, so if our lives are surrounded by all these connected devices and we've chosen to go there and everybody's like that now because all devices are connected to the internet somehow, what does that say about kind of the civil liberties that we have built up around ourselves and have enjoyed for a very long time in this new world where everything is capable of being tracked and traced and monetized and that's 10 years from now. That's now for the next 10 years, it's going to get crazy.
Well, so this is something that we talked about, I think, last week, and we were talking about the role of government and regulation about like privacy. And this ties directly into that is we are right now at a stage where we're relying on companies to be the benign actors in this scenario of data mining everything and us not having a choice whether or not we're going to be part of this. I think we will see really well-off people buy unconnected devices. We'll probably see a robust eBay economy and like old dumb things like, heck, my mom won't even buy a car that has power locks. It's kind of ridiculous. yes. But we're also like the amount of data that these things are connecting is insane. And I just tweeted before the show, I was talking about Uber because more stuff is coming out about Uber. And to me, this is the perfect example of an IoT company that is running amok with your data and doing things that are just incredibly unethical and not being penalized for it in ways. I mean, everything from, you know, the first mess ups around God view and like showing, oh, look, there's Beyonce driving around New York right now, you know, to the latest allegations about like people there having access to someone's medical records. You know, I'm like, oh, we have to start doing something about this because It is not going to be pretty, and we can't really rely on these companies to really protect us and not be jerks.
Man, that's overwhelming.
Sorry.
I completely agree. I think we would all probably agree with that 100%. It's just like, what do you do? I mean, do we hit a point where we look backwards and we go, man, maybe I should not have shared as maybe I should not have been entranced by all of that technology as much as I was because look where I am now. Do you think that?
Well, you can step it back even further. I mean, just anybody who's ever had to deal with a credit report, and you're like, where'd they get this information on me? And this information isn't correct. And now I got to try to get it fixed. Yeah. And that's a nightmare process that you go through. And we have some laws that allow us to deal with this sort of stuff, but we don't have laws that prevent all that stuff being flowing into one place, every purchase you've ever made and what happens with all that sort of stuff. And who, you know, just imagine what you do with your credit card alone.
Yeah.
Right. And what are your protections with that? And how do you push a button? I mean, and we can, and I'm not taken away from the internet companies, but if I want to purge all my stuff on Google, I've got a dashboard where I can do it. If I want to purge all the things that I purchased on my credit card, I don't know how far stuff that goes. I don't know how to get rid of those things. I don't know where all that stuff is. So, you know,
police can get access to that data.
Yeah. So, you know, eventually they'll get me for that person I wiped out. No, I didn't. But you know, we could use a better protection, I think, for just period, better consumer protection overall. And I don't want it to be just limited to internet companies. I'd like to see a good fundamental bill of rights that we have in terms of what information you can gather about us, what information you can compile in various sources and put together, and what our ability is to purge some of this stuff if we want to purge it, and apply it not just to the internet and tech companies, but just companies in general, especially because I don't want like loopholes to get through, you know? But
Yeah, that's
no, I like that. That's a good idea. I mean, because that's true. Right now, there are the tech companies, but I also have devices that are made by companies that aren't technically tech companies, and they're sucking down data as much as they can. So,
I mean, anybody who's gone to a grocery store and then when the receipt spits out you go to a grocery store, and of course you have a loyalty card, and then the loyalty card gives you the discount, and then the receipt spits out a coupon based on the past purchases that you've made, and you're like, oh, I guess you know the you're keeping track of all the things I've purchased, and you know who gets to see that and that sort of stuff. So,
but yeah. 50 cents off of a package of Ritz, I'm all for that.
Yeah, there we
Worth
go.
It.
we use so here's you can play the loyalty card game. You just swap people's loyalty cards around. Maybe that's
sure.
We create like a consumer network where you're like, all right, I'll mail you my stuff. You use this stuff.
But it's like, but it's also, if you go back to Uber, it always drives you crazy when people either have thought of Uber as a tech company or as a ride hailing company, because I don't know what the hell ride hailing was. I think of them as a taxi service, right? They're a taxi company. But if you're going to consider them to be a tech company because they use technology to get a taxi to you, then our grocery stores are tech companies. Like, what isn't a tech company at that point, right? Who isn't using technology these days other than maybe my small local business that sells me milk when the grocery store is closed that isn't kind of doing that sort of stuff? So, yeah, our tech companies are broader than what we think of in terms of tech companies, and the amount of data that's being gathered about us is even broader than we can imagine, just with the stuff that we already know.
It's interesting what you were just saying about you know, using a loyalty card and then getting a coupon for, you know, a discount on something you've bought in the past. I remember it was a couple of weeks ago that there was news that Google was going to be working with credit card companies or something to be able to track your purchases, your spending inside stores, and be able to offer you advertising around that. And that's, you know, that definitely had some people talking about the creepy line and, wow, now Google knows everything that I buy in stores. But that's basically what you're talking about, Danny. And we've been doing it for years with loyalty cards. We didn't have a problem with it then. It just goes back to what people actually understand about what's happening behind the scenes, or just accepting the fact that it does, and we've been okay with it to a certain degree in one way. You know, what's different about the way it is now that it's a little bit more technologically tied, you know, in a sense of the internet, or I'm not sure, but that changes. Wow, that was a rabbit hole. That was fun.
Wow. Well, we'll need something to uplift us.
Oh, boy.
Hey, let's talk about HomePod.
Yay. Thank you. That's a great segue. Yes. Okay. So I don't know how – do you guys talk about Apple on this show very much? Probably doesn't happen very often. But
you know what? We talk about everything on this show.
Anything
and
everything.
I mean, really, it's a free-for-all.
Google.
Sometimes we even hit Google. Exactly.
Hey, we started with Google. We did all right. There just isn't a whole lot of Google news this week. So obviously Apple had their big WWDC event and keynote on Monday. And of all the things that were demonstrated to developers and things like, you know, laptops, new MacBooks, new iMacs, whatever, probably the star of the show, I would say, and the thing that people were wondering if it was going to happen and if they were going to see it, is Apple's answer to the Amazon Echo, or maybe it's Apple's answer to the Sonos speaker with a little bit of Siri tied into it. It's called the HomePod, and it's kind of Apple's foray into this home assistant world. It's speaker first, though. Everyone that I've read that's heard one of these things says the sound is tremendous. Like it puts out a really nice sound, and especially when compare it to
the
Echo.
When people listen to that sound in a room that Apple set up next to an Apple Echo and Sonos, it was amazing that the Apple sound, but it probably is good sound.
It's probably, I'm guessing it's probably a little better than the Echo. They did a good job of the design. What do you think, Stacey?
Well, I was going to just say, this isn't out till December.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways the good speaker is fine, but you know, and Apple did mention, I think on a slide, that it was a personal assistant too, but that is so clearly missing. And my hunch is it's missing because Siri right now is not worth talking about as a personal assistant.
Yeah.
And so what I expect is in the next few months, they're going to be working hard on Siri, maybe showing something off in September at the hardware launches that they do. And then, you know, when it's out in December, we'll see it. So I wouldn't discount it on the basis like, yeah, it's a good speaker. I would expect nothing less from Apple. Music is its DNA. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, it really did feel like they put Siri totally second fiddle to the idea of this being a speaker. And that felt to me like an admission that Siri wasn't worth featuring as a front and center highlight point. Although maybe, you know, it's an expensive piece of gear. It's $350 right around there?
Yeah, this is not something a lot of people are going to put in every room. I mean, you look at the Amazon strategy, which is, you know, get people in the door, the Echo's pretty cool, or you give them a $50 dot, right?
Yeah.
And this feels like something that's, I don't, would you put this in every room at $350? I don't know.
Someone would, but I wouldn't.
Well, yes, but like, everyone? And then with the Google Home, I kind of feel like I have one and a lot of the stuff you can do on your phone. So that may be like the poor man's way of getting all of these features. It may not be a bad idea.
I'm perfectly happy with my Google Home. I make no secret about that. I have one now in the kitchen and I have one in the living room. And of course, you know, as I get more and more Hue bulbs, that becomes kind of neat to be able to do a voice command and turn on my lights, which is kind of like, okay, great. You know, like that's neat and everything. How essential is it? But I mean, I use my home all the time. My family uses the home all the time for music. Like we're always playing music, playing playlists. It's really easy to fire off a playlist. So when I saw the HomePod, I was like, well, that's actually pretty nice. As a music device, a voice activated music device that actually sounds really good. Personally, I'm satisfied with the way Google Home sounds for my ears. But if you have a more tuned ear and you require more out of the sound coming out of that little pod in the corner of your room, maybe it's worth $350. Danny, what voice assistants do you have? Is this appealing to you at all?
I have both the Home and the Echo. And, I think generally it's smart in the sense that the primary thing I think people say they do on these devices is playing music. Mm-hmm. So the idea that, wow, that's what people like a lot is that I can play music on these things. So we'll come up with a great music playing device. That's an interesting strategy. But I also don't know to the degree that people play music on this or audiophiles, right? Because I have a home speaker system and like my wife listens to music a lot and occasionally she remembers, oh, I can stream to that and she likes it. And the music's much better coming out of that because it's like all the speakers. But, you know, typically she just kind of wants some casual music playing and the Echo's good enough. And so I think that... Yep. I think that if you get into that price range, you're going to go, this really is a replacement for my home speaker system because maybe I've already made that kind of investment. Or I don't know how that will play out. But I do think that even though the primary thing people do with these devices is play music, I think they like the other aspects to it as well. I think they like the idea that Echo gives them information and news. Certainly the smart home connected stuff is very helpful. And I'll be interested to see how. First of all, I don't know whether or not like the HomePod's going to deal with, say, Spotify. I assume that there's going to be some option for that to do it, but if there isn't, to me, that's almost going to make it dead in the water for a lot of people because I listen to Spotify. We listen Spotify is what we're getting all of our stuff off of, not Apple Music. And if it's a pure Apple Music device, there's a lot of people who use other alternatives, and both the Echo and the Home will turn to Spotify as well as Amazon Music, as well as their native
Google,
things.
Google
that they
won't
have.
Play Amazon Music, and the Echo Sorry. Won't play YouTube. Sorry, no, I'm like.
Right, but what I mean is they both go to third parties or they both have their own native stuff to fall back on so mm-hmm. that if you're a Google user, you could use Google Music. So if I would assume that your Apple Music will be the default for HomePod and that hopefully they allow you to use, say, like Spotify. I wouldn't expect them to use Google Music, but we'll see. But the assistant aspect I think will be important, and I think Siri's pretty dumb. And I don't see Siri getting any smarter anytime sooner. And I especially think that – so you're going to roll out a speaker that sounds better than the Echo but is probably stupider than the Echo, which itself is already stupider than the Google Home. And if people actually want a little bit more out of these things, just playing music, it's not a compelling thing. It's sort of an also-ran. So, yeah.
Yeah, then in that sense, it's a competitor to Sonos, which already I think a lot of people see as – overly expensive I mean, there's definitely a fan base for Sonos hardware, you know, for kind of the interconnected speaker system. But I mean, once Google, you know, they released their Chromecast audio, and then now Google Home is like an extension of that. They can be their own points for this like network.
And Google Homes will already network with each other. Mm-hmm. Right, you can have two Google Homes, and they will do the playing in multiple rooms. Although I don't think the sound quality in the Home is as good as the Echo, personally, but not that big a deal to me, right? You know, I'm three drinks in, I don't really care about the sound quality.
I would consider like I'm a musician. I feel like I have an ear for sound, but I don't care about the sound quality of Google Home. It does exactly what I want it to do. It's a small, but you know, it takes up very small footprint on the windowsill of my kitchen, and it's there to very easily play some music on a, you know, in a flash when I'm like bored and want some music while I'm washing dishes or cooking dinner or something. That's all I really need it for. I'm not looking at that little device to be like the most pristine audiophile experience in the world. That's just not why I bought it, and I'm happy.
And this reminds me of the MP3 debates from back in the day. Yeah. I'm like, oh, here we are again.
I think they're gonna sell a lot of these. There are people who definitely care about sound quality. I'm sure the sound quality be great. I'm sure some people are great. I love my Apple thing. This is the best thing. It's the wonderful thing. I'm putting it in all my different rooms, and it takes away from me having to have all these speakers or whatever. But you know, I think there's a lot of other people who don't care that much.
There's also the fact that this is going to be available internationally to a greater extent than either the Echo or the Google Home have been up until now. So just that availability alone is going to bring
people. When do we get this? December?
December.
Yeah. So it's like, well, it's going to be tough for Christmas gifts and such.
That's an expensive Christmas gift.
Yeah.
$350.
That was one of the smarter things the Echo did with, like, the Echo was it launched at actually $100 for people.
Oh, that's right, it did.
Then at $180, you're like, woof. But then they came out soon after with the Dot. And, you know, if you already had an Echo, you're like, well, crap, I can stick a Dot everywhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And again, so I would look in the next couple months for Siri to get better, because, you know, Apple's not dumb. They know where their weak points are, and they are addressing them. Two, I would look for the Amazon Echo Sonos integration, because I think that's going to be a really important thing for retaining that market. And then three, I would look to see what they do on privacy. Like, Apple really did talk a lot about privacy, and not just in a ho-hum way, but they talked about encrypting the data, not just that the device isn't always listening, but that they're encrypting the data to and from servers, and they're anonymizing it on the servers on the back end. And that's a really big deal.
I would agree. But my question about that, I'm happy you brought that up, because I think anonymizing it on the back end is a big deal for privacy. It's something that Google, as one example, can't do, because they're so tied into their cloud information around you that anonymizing it would negate. Didn't they have the same reason for why they couldn't encrypt Allo? Is because if they encrypted it, then you wouldn't get that extra assistant functionality built in around your specific account. So I think that's the reason that they don't do that. So that's a big deal from a privacy perspective. This always listening thing that they touted, don't they all do that? They all listen.
They always listen.
They just don't send it up to the cloud. They wait for the keyword, and then that's the thing that they grab onto. Right?
Yeah. Yes. That's how they all work.
Okay.
I'm sorry, was Apple saying they were doing something different? Or?
Well, that's what
Apple,
I couldn't
tell. So Apple says that it listens for latency on the device, whereas Amazon sends 5-second loops that are basically always getting deleted to its servers for the Echo.
Well, that's interesting.
Okay. All right. And that's why that case, there was a case a month or two ago about a crime that had happened.
So we learned about the case a while ago, but several months ago. Mm-hmm. But it was actually like a 2016 or 2015. It was a 2015 maybe murder.
Okay.
But yes.
That's really interesting. I didn't realize Amazon was sending stuff up. I assumed it had a device-specific hot word that caused it to wake up.
No. But
did Amazon
confirm
that?
They've always talked about that's how it works.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting.
Now, Google Home, is it just looking for the word, and then once it detects that on device, then it prompts you for your query and that sends to the cloud? Is that the only thing that goes to your cloud is your query?
I don't know specifically how Google Home works. I was like, words, what's it called?
It's okay. That's my understanding. Or at least that's always been my belief. And I'm now at this point where I'm trying to figure out, is that based on something I read or is that just an assumption that I made? ScooterX in chat says yes. That's always been my understanding, is that Google Home also, it's an open mic. It's just, but on device, it's waiting to hear that, hey, G or okay, G. Once it hears that, you do your query. That's the thing that gets sent up to the cloud. It's not doing it all the time.
I was pretty sure the Google Home had an on-device hot word, just as like I thought the Xbox and Cortana or the whatever it was before, that they were on-device hot words, that right. They were always listening just to whether or not they heard the hot word. And when they hear the hot word, that's when they would go to the cloud. So,
All right. Yeah, but I mean, anonymizing that and, you know, in the cloud, that's something that Apple can do because their business is not built around this massive trove of information and data that's been built up around you that makes Siri more useful. So it'll be interesting to see how Apple does improve Siri to compete with some of these other home assistants because they just don't have as much information on you. And that's the kind of stuff that makes people go, oh, wow, that's really useful. It knows my calendar or whatever the case may be.
Well, I think the other big change, though, if I remember or understood it right from what they were saying with the WWDC, was that Siri was now going to be smarter across your devices. Because currently right now, Siri is device specific. Because Apple's real like, we don't send any of that stuff out. So Siri learns your thing on one device. And then if you were to have an iPad, Siri on the iPad doesn't know the same things that Siri on the iPhone understands. Just like if you had a HomePod, Siri on the HomePod wouldn't necessarily know that, except right. that they're making a change now where it's all encrypted and it's magical and it's privacy protected or whatever. But I think that they said that now Siri is actually going to be cross-device. And that's a significant change because that allows them to then let Siri get smarter because you have a common Siri profile rather than a device-specific Siri profile, if I'm understanding all the things that it was saying that it does. Mm-hmm. But to go back... to the other thing with Stacey was saying on the Siri getting smarter, it's going to be really hard for them to make Siri smarter because Siri doesn't get smarter unless you start letting Bing do stuff. Because right now, Siri's designed to just... This guy only talks to... this guy only deals with a set number of very vetted databases that it can have. Like, what's the weather? Set a timer. Yep. Do these very specific things. And then if you want to go beyond that, of course, you have to have installed the apps or whatever they call them. Siri will answer a lot of common vetted stuff that they have as well. And then if you try to go beyond that, it tries to hit various databases, like, oh, I'll go to Yelp or I'll go to this. And then ultimately it decides, well, I'll try to go to Bing. And usually it's sort of this half-hearted effort that's not very useful. Google, when you ask it, goes to Google. There's none of this like, well, I'm trying to figure this, or maybe I can go over here, or maybe somebody else. There's like, Google, I know everything. I mean, it doesn't know everything, but it knows a lot, and it's not got this delay of, well, I'm not certain about this. Let me ask someone else to see if someone else knows, and then I'll just throw it out there. So, you know, they don't just get to make Siri Google Home smart by flipping a few switches. They don't have a search engine. they don't have a deep integration like Google has. And so, you know, they might get it closer to doing what an Amazon Echo does, but you know, I don't see them getting anywhere close to what a Google Home does unless they want to really let Microsoft into that device a lot more than they're doing now. And, you know, they've been years in not doing that. The other question that will come up is whether they're allowed to do that. So they use Bing for Siri as the backup. They still use Google as the backup in Safari. And I don't know how their contract would work with... We're serving stuff out of Siri. Is that coming off of Google or is that coming off of Bing and who's it providing or whatever? So I don't know. It's been the one area that Apple has not really done as much as people think with in terms of having and owning and and operating their own search service, they don't have that. And I think that's going to hinder them in terms of making that the home assistant that some people may want.
From an IoT standpoint, Stacey, I mean, you know, you when it comes to controlling devices in your home, do you think that the fact that this has HomeKit, obviously, that's kind of part of the strength from Apple's perspective. Is that a strong enough sell for IoT enthusiasts?
You know, I don't think a lot of people are really into HomeKit. Like, there are people who are into HomeKit, but I don't think it's a mass market thing. What I think HomeKit may have going, this actually may galvanize people to actually know about HomeKit and buy HomeKit. Mm-hmm. Because when you are an Apple user and you activate a device from your iPhone, like a new connected device, it'll see that your phone is on your network and this device is on your network, and they'll be like, hey, do you want to use HomeKit? And you're like, sure. And then you're like, ooh, magic. And then you have control of this device that you may not really care much about. But if you've done it enough times, and you see, and then you bring like a HomePod into the home, that gets interesting, because then you might be like, Apple will, I assume, tell you that, hey, by the way, you know, you could talk to this and control your thermostat because it's a HomeKit thermostat. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly people might suddenly wake up to the fact that, holy cow, I have a connected house and I didn't even really realize it. I don't know if that's going to happen, but.
I mean, I have a lot of things that are on HomeKit, and there go my lights now. I don't know if you can see. I'm clicking off. I'm doing it off my phone, mm-hmm. And I've got there we are. I mean, HomeKit when it works is really wonderful, and sometimes is easier to me than trying to set something up with the Alexa. But not everything works with HomeKit. So then you're like, whoa. Whereas one of the things that I think the Echo, more than any of them, seems to work with everything now. Like, mm-hmm. I struggle to find something that it can't handle that's a connected device in my house. Whereas, you know, the Google still has some things it won't do, and then HomeKit or Apple has a few things it won't talk to.
Yeah, I mean, Google's
HomeKit
getting
has
there.
A bunch of stuff it won't talk to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, HomeKit, I mean, I'm way less knowledgeable on the Apple ecosystem side of things, but HomeKit is pretty much specific to just iOS, right? Like, are there devices that are HomeKit and also support other platforms, or if they're HomeKit, they are only HomeKit?
No, there are bridge devices and devices that do both.
Okay.
The challenge with HomeKit is that you have to have a physical chip right now inside the device. For it to be certified mm-hmm. for a HomeKit device, mm-hmm. which means mm-hmm. that if you've got older devices that aren't, if you've bought into a smart home, right, and maybe they weren't HomeKit certified, they're never going to become HomeKit certified. But, here comes the but. They did put this in they did talk about this at WWDC, and Apple made a reference, and I can't wait to find out more, to making it easier to certify or to get HomeKit devices connected. So, but it was a very cryptic thing in a press release. So I'm like, could it be software enabled? I don't know.
Hmm. And they might be able to. So like I had like the Hue lights, my original hub with Hue, I don't think was HomeKit. So when I upgraded mm-hmm. the HomeKit Hue, I think the second one was, I believe it was.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so when I got the new hub, then all my individual lights worked. And like I have the Lutron lights that are HomeKit, but then Amazon can work with them and Google can work with them. But my Lifix bulbs, they don't have a hub, and they're each individual bulbs. And I have like 12 of them in various places, and they're not going to get HomeKit. You know, I'd have to throw those bulbs away. But maybe, and this maybe goes to what you were saying, Stacey, is that they could talk to say my Apple TV, or they could talk to a HomePod if the HomePod wanted them to, right? It wouldn't be that hard
bridge,
to set them up. But
yes,
but
if you have
the HomePod itself, if the HomePod itself acts as a bridge, that might be a way to basically HomeKitify a lot of devices that don't have the HomeKit chips built into them. And that's
an interesting thought. But that would kind of break Apple's security model. Because that's what HomeKit's all about. So that would be actually interesting. So the HomeKit certification is built into the HomePod as a bridge. I like it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, today was HomeKit Day at WWE. I can never say this. I've got too many W's.
WWDC. DC.
So there's a lot more stuff that we have now. Yeah. We'll see.
Good. All right. So then you're going to have all three of these things in your house. And then the Harman Kardon one, and then the Essential Home.
I already have, I already have a dozen hubs. So, what's a few more?
What's a few more? You're going to have a room that is nothing but home assistants waiting for you to fire them off. Waiting for you to put them to work.
Oh, that is true. I still have some rooms that we can trick out with gear.
Oh boy, that's awesome. All right, so let's see here. Is there anything in here? I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here that we haven't talked about. Is there anything that like really catches your eyes before we get to kind of tips and tricks and picks and all that kind of stuff? Anything that you wanted to talk about that we haven't touched on before we move on? And it's okay if there's not, because we've got other things too. Like tips.
There's the Amazon Ice smartphones. I don't know if we care about those.
Okay, absolutely. Actually, let's talk about that real quick. The Amazon Fire Phone, the opposite of fire, is ice. And apparently Amazon is working on a new take on their phones. The Fire Phone was, let's just say it was a little bit of a failure when it launched a few years ago. Did not last very long. It kind of had some gimmicky kind of aspects to it, and it was a failure. It didn't work. But apparently Amazon's back to the drawing board. The internal name for it supposedly is Ice. Don't know if that's branding that's going to make it to release if and when it ever comes out. But it seems like it's more targeting the device that's in the works is targeting kind of the lower-end market in emerging markets, specifically like India, somewhere around $93 when you convert it from Indian rupees. But big difference this time is that Amazon doesn't do this with their Android devices. So this would be a first, is that it would have Google mobile services on it. So it would have the Google Play Store. It would have Google apps like navigation or maps, Android messages, whatever. It has that whole package that you get on a phone that's officially GMS certified. And that would be a big shift in Amazon's kind of mobile strategy. In the past, they've been very, very much about their app store, keeping you in on all things Amazon on that device. This would be a change, a transition away from that. What do you guys think? Are you getting one?
No.
No. I guess because...
A low-end Android phone? No. No, yeah. I can't tell if it's Amazon trying to make up for some data it doesn't own because it's not on the phone and it recognizes that's important, or if it's recognizing that's important, it's like, well, we'll get in on the ground floor here in India with these low-cost phones and see if that works.
Yeah.
So, I mean, either way, I think Amazon's signaling here that having a mobile component is important, and it recognizes to get there, it's going to have to take a slightly different strategy because the U.S. market is pretty saturated and... I guess if I were Andy Rubin, I'd be like, oh, crap, what's going to happen with the Essential phone?
Well, I mean, when you really look at how successful Amazon has been and all of the other places that they are present, like when you look at it, not and let's say you didn't know that the Fire Phone ever existed, you'd be scratching your head wondering why Amazon wasn't doing a phone, because that makes perfect sense for everything that they're trying to achieve. Yet they did try it. And they failed pretty miserably at it. So it makes sense that they'd go back again. Hitting a deal with Google. Obviously, Google wants as many partners and would love to have Amazon on its side of the ship. I don't know what that means for Amazon devices going forward, because my understanding of GMS, of that agreement, is that once you go in on it, your future phones have to all also carry that. Otherwise, you're breaking the terms of the deal. So I don't know if that means that, okay, well, I guess now, our phones, I don't know if that also extends to tablets. My understanding is that it does, but maybe it doesn't. But that their future devices would have to have some sort of Google, Google Play, Play Store and all their services on it. That would be a big shift. But
do you have a problem? But probably a smart one, because I don't think they're getting there in terms of, you know, we're going to have our own play, we're going to have our own app store, and we're going to have our own thing. It's like, you know, you're probably just going to do better if you dive into the Android space.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Let's see here. You mentioned Essential. Apparently, there is a trademark dispute. Not even a week later after Andy Rubin showed off his Essential phone and Essential Home, Spigen, which is the cell phone case slash, you know, battery pack maker, has a trademark for Essential. Since August of 2016, a range of battery packs and chargers that they sell with the Essential brand on it, also some Bluetooth headphones. So they charge that Essential, the phone, being a phone company, is too similar, too confusing, and apparently Essential, the phone company, applied for this registration and it was refused. One could assume why, because it existed already. But they went ahead with it anyways. Andy was like, whatever, we got this. So now it's a case.
Well, that's crazy that they were denied their trademark and then they still went and did it.
Yeah.
That feels, I don't know. Of course, remember Apple took on Cisco with iOS. As a networking nerd, I knew what iOS was before the rest of you, when it was something completely different.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cisco finally caved. So maybe that's the playbook that, you know, Andy Rubin's running from. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows on that one. But it was still kind of, it was a bold move on Andy's company's part. Essential says, threat letters are commonplace in our sector. While it's Spigen's prerogative to make assertions, Essential believes they are without merit and will respond appropriately. So we'll see what that appropriate response is. I think we did all right. I think we covered.
Okay. We could talk about Amazon doing Prime for what used to be food stamps.
Do it.
Which I thought was let me pull up the story, which is open in one of these tabs. I'm like, oh dear God. Hold on. Is it EBT, I think is what it's called now?
The food stamp EBT, program? Yes. Electronic Benefits Transfer Card.
Thank you. Basically, they reduced the Prime, the $99 a year you pay for Prime to, was it 45? Here it is. I found it. It's $5.99. So $6 from basically $11 a month. You have to have your electronics benefit transfer card. And you don't have to use that card for Amazon purchases, only for verification.
Right.
So this is really interesting because it makes me kind of wonder, one, is Amazon just trying to increase Prime? But two, you know, remember that kerfuffle about Amazon not being in low-income neighborhoods? I think it was Bloomberg did a really good data analysis. And one of the reasons Amazon said it wasn't was because it didn't have one of the metrics it looks at when trying to decide where to do like now delivery zones was, or Amazon Now, so the really rapid delivery, was the number of Prime subscriptions in that area. So I thought this might be kind of both just a nice way, like a way to get people who aren't as wealthy on the program, but also might give Amazon, you know, a better insight and better ways to like serve communities that, I mean, some of these places don't have access to, you know, cheaper groceries and things like toilet paper.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, potentially people could actually save a lot of money if they could shop on Amazon with some of the sale prices that happen and get that shipping kind of included in there. One of the statistics I found is that historically Prime subscribers have made $112,000 in a household per year or more. 70% of all Prime subscribers fall into that category. And so Amazon's missing out on a whole other tier of potential customers that could totally, you know, buy some of the products that maybe go on sale or whatever, you know, buy the lower cost items as they happen. It just opens them up to a new market.
Yeah, the Walmart market.
Mm-hmm.
Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah, and actually 30-day free trial on that. So people who are interested, in order to validate, like you said, you need the EBT card, the electronic benefits transfer card. And then once you validate, you can get a 30-day free trial, amazon.com/qualify. Amazon apparently is also working with the government on ways to allow food stamps to be used for some purchases as well. So they're really opening up. Trying to, anyways.
Yeah, there are more people than ever on food stamps. You look at people who are like adjunct professors on food stamps. There are teachers on food stamps. This is not, there's a lot of people that, could really take a benefit of this. Mm-hmm. So.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Anything else? Anything? Going once?
I'm good.
Going twice. Sold to tips, tricks, and numbers, or whatever we have. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. Stacey, what do you have? What's your thing today?
Okay, I just got this. So this is a friend of mine recommended this to me because I've been having trouble sleeping. It is snooze.
Let me guess. It's spelled S-N-U-Z.
S-N-O-O-Z.
Oh, okay.
So close.
All right, close.
So it is basically it's a white noise machine. It has an actual fan inside. Does that matter? I don't know.
It does. I actually would agree. I love sleeping to white noise, and we have an electronic one that just plays the sound, and then we have one that's an actual mechanical motion white noise, and I totally know the difference. I appreciate the difference. So I'm right there.
All right.
Yeah.
So this is the sound of the snooze.
Wow.
There it's soft. Going on. Okay, stop snoozing. And so the reason I bought it is because it's connected to the internet.
Of course.
I know. Was I talking earlier about how all of our devices are going to be connected and how we shouldn't have all this stuff? Yes, slap my hand.
It's kind of your thing, Stacey. I understand.
It is, but... So... Yes, and all the app does is just let you control it from your bed. If it's not like right next to you on the table, you can just open your app and be like, and dial it down your Watchman trigger. I think you can also schedule stuff. I literally just opened this before the show, so I haven't played with it yet. But I'm very excited about it because so many people have told me so many good things. It's kind of pricey. I'm gonna let you know. So,
How much is it?
Oh, what? You want actual prices? What? That's crazy. How much did I pay for this? I think I got mine on sale, but I think it's...
$79.
Thank you. I was like, I think it's $80, so it's not cheap.
It's not too bad. I don't know. I don't know what white noise machines cost these days.
But it's compact. I mean, this is like something, if you... Like, I could bring this to my hotel, and I feel like it would be... Like, here's my phone in case my head is not a good indicator.
Phone and head for scale.
Oh, that helps. Now I can visualize it. Before, I was struggling. I only had your hand to.
Exactly.
Everything's going in this, like, mesh cylindrical design direction.
Oh, yeah. So trendy right now. Good Lord.
My goodness. They all look meshy and round or cylindrical.
Well, I feel like, 2 years ago, everything was square with rounded edges and like blue LEDs. Here's a good example of, design from, last year. Oh,
yeah.
Last year or 2 years ago, this year.
Uh-huh. Yep. My, how far things have come from a squircle to a circle. All right. So, Danny, what you got? It says in here, Danny's stuff. So what's your stuff?
I'll just give you a quick thing. You can maybe find it real quick if you Google for Google Ads personal search filter. They experimented with it about last week, and the main thing was you could do a search, and you got this little tab that came up that said personal. And if you clicked on it and you had everything all linked together, it just let you search through things like your Gmail and stuff from regular Google. We've had this before with Google Search Plus My World. But it looks like they're experimenting with making it possible for you to deliberately just look through the stuff you've stored on Google itself. Now it's gone, but maybe it'll come back because it looks like they're experimenting. So not really a tip you can do right now, but keep an eye out on it. Maybe it'll come back.
Oh, find personal in the more drop down.
Yeah.
To jump into that. Nice.
And that's it.
All right. Excellent. That works for me. Mine's a quick one. I didn't even know this existed until last night. We were doing an email on All About Android, and there was a young budding programmer who wanted to know how to learn Kotlin, because if you remember Google I.O., Kotlin was a big deal to developers that were there.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you're starting to want to get into developing for Android, the question is, you know, do you go the traditional route, or is it better to start off with Kotlin? Because everyone seems to really think that Kotlin is a much easier direction to go for, you know, for programming for Android, for coding for Android. So why not start there? And right now, Udemy is having has cut the price of their Kotlin for Beginners course. It's Learn Programming with Kotlin. It's a 6.5 hours of on-demand video, a bunch of supplemental resources, certificate of completion if you need that certificate. But it basically kind of walks you through the beginning process of Kotlin for beginners. And normally it's $95, but apparently it's on sale right now for like $10. That's only going to be at that cost for the next 2 days. So I was just thinking, if you are thinking about getting into coding, you want to learn a little bit more about Kotlin, here's a great way to do it for next to nothing. And it might be a good kind of beginner's course, good way to kind of kickstart your education around what Kotlin means. And then the next time at Google I.O. they make some big announcement about Kotlin, you can go crazy like all the developers did this last year. You can be part of the crowd. So there you go. Learn Kotlin, Kotlin for Beginners at Udemy, Udemy. And you could do a search for the course there. But I think we've hit the end of This Week in Google. That was a lot of fun. I love the rabbit hole that we got there in the middle. We were on a roll. That was fun.
Did we ever talk about what Danny got so upset about in the beginning?
Yeah, we did.
Okay, good.
That was all the HomePod stuff. So we definitely got to it.
Okay. I was like, I couldn't remember. I was like, Danny got really excited about something. What was it?
I got my excitement going. We
covered all the bases. I think we did a great job. Danny Sullivan, it's always a pleasure getting the chance to do a show with you and to see you again. Thank you so much for coming on today. Tell people kind of a little bit about what you're working on, where they can find all your work online.
We have three different sites, Search Engine Land for all your search marketing and search news, Marketing Land for digital marketing information, and then we have our MarTech site for people who are up on marketing technology stuff. So that's MarTech Today.
Excellent. And you're at Danny Sullivan on Twitter.
On Twitter, yeah.
Always fun. Thank you, Danny. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Stacy, again, always a pleasure hopping on with you. You're not going to be on next week, though, right? You're out.
I'm not.
Dang it. That's okay.
I know.
I got to podcast with you today, and Jeff missed out. Stacy Higginbotham, of course, IoTpodcast.com. What do you want to point people to?
You can go to IoTpodcast.com, which is only my podcast, or you can go to Stacy on IoT, and then you get podcasts plus stories. Woo!
Woo! Like the stories, and at Giga Stacy on Twitter. Thanks again, Stacy. Have a good week off of this show. I don't know about anything else in your life, but this show at least. You can find me all over the Twit Network. I'm doing shows like All About Android, where we talk about Android. I'm doing shows about tech news. That show is called Tech News Today. See, we make the naming really kind of make sense to what you actually get. Having fun all across the map. So find me all over those places, or find me on Twitter at Jason Howell. This Week in Google, of course, we record every Wednesday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to watch live, you can. You just go to twit.tv/live, and you can catch it in real time as it happens. I know it's a crazy thing. But if you can't do that, that's okay. We post all the shows online at the site. Just go to twit.tv/twig, T-W-I-G, for This Week in Google, and you can find all of our episodes, everything that you need about this show is there. And by the way, I think if you go to twit.tv/store, you can get a shirt with Twig on it as well. Just a little bonus there. If you don't have your Twig shirt yet, go get it, and you can profess your true fandom of this show. I will be happy to return next week. I'll be here on set, so I'll be looking forward to that show. But as for now, that's all we have for This Week in Google this week. We'll see you next week. Take care, you guys.